It's autumn. The leaves are starting to change from green to bright yellows, oranges, and reds. It's a perfect time for Mike Brunk. He's the arborist for the city of Urbana and one of our guests today on Focus. Mike says this should be a good year for fall colors, and he can tell us why some years are better than others. Mike will also have an update on how the emerald ash borer is affecting ash trees in east central Illinois. Plus, horticulture expert Sandy Mason is back with us today from the University of Illinois Extension. She'll have answers for your lawn and gardening questions. I'm Jim Meadows. Join me for a lawn, gardening, and trees edition of Focus on WILL. Our program continues after the news. Welcome to Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. We're doing another show devoted to your lawn and garden questions, and also your questions about trees. Horticulturalist Sandy Mason from the University of Illinois Extension is back with us today. Welcome to the show, Sandy.
Thank you.
And also on the show today, Mike Brunk, fighting a cold and phoning in, kindly not trying to avoid giving it to us. But glad to have you with us. Mike Brunk is the arborist for the city of Urbana. Mike, welcome to the program. I'm wondering, what does a city arborist do?
Well, the city arborist of Urbana does a number of things. The main focus is managing the urban forest. But with my landscape architect background, I dabble also in the beautification of the city. And back in the 90s, I took over the management of the Landscape Recycling Center. So it's kind of a multitasking job.
I noticed the city of Urbana has a tree commission, and you're sort of listed on the city's website as the tree commission's staff. So you're doing work as far as figuring out the part of the city forest, I guess, that the city is responsible for. Are there certain areas in which the city has control over trees going up or down?
You mean as far as trees being planted and removed?
Yes.
Yes, we manage the trees on city right of ways,
and that would be the parts going right up next to the street. I take it.
Right between, generally speaking, it's between the street and the sidewalk.
Okay.
Now there's some odd areas where we have trees behind the sidewalks, and we have some mini parks in the areas in the community as well. But we manage the forest for the health of the forest and for the safety of the public.
Well, Mike Brunk and Sandy Mason are both here to answer your lawn, garden, and tree questions. You can call in toll-free at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL. You can email us at will-talk, W-I-L-L-talk, at illinois.edu, and we welcome your questions on Facebook and Twitter at Focus580. Mike, this is the time of year. It's October when the leaves start to change colors. Some years the color changes are brighter than usual. Do you have any idea? Can you predict what sort of fall foliage we'll see this year?
Well, I think we could see some very bright colors. Now, most would think because we've had a drought that the trees are stressed and the colors might not be so brilliant this year. I think they may not, the trees may not be as full foliated, but I think the colors could be as brilliant as in the past or even more so this year. And that's due to the bright days and the cool nights. So the chlorophyll is the green pigment that you see in the leaves, of course, in the summer. And as that dissipates, it unmasks the other colors that are there, which are the yellows and the oranges. And we're starting to see that now with the trees kind of being drought stressed. So the fact that they're turning early, I think, limits the potential for them to get frosted, and therefore we, you know, would see some colors before they get frosted. And then secondly, the other pigments, the reds and the purples and the combinations thereof, are produced by the sugar being broken down in bright light. And we've had plenty of bright sunny days and cool nights. So that combination, bright sunny days, not overly hot, and cool evenings should bring us some pretty bright reds and purples in our trees.
So these are colors which are actually, when we're looking at those green leaves throughout the summer, hiding underneath the chlorophyll or concealed underneath the green chlorophyll are the colors we can see in the fall.
The yellows and the oranges certainly are, and then the reds are produced later in the year. But yes, it's all masked by the chlorophyll, and once that starts to dissipate, then the true colors, the pretty colors are shown.
I'm wondering, and this is more of a long-term proposition, whether it's a question for you, Mike, or for you, Sandy, if you wanted to make sure you had the best chances for bright colors in your yard using trees but also bushes and shrubbery, what's the best thing to plant?
Well, I think part of it, what I always encourage people to do if they're really looking for a good fall color is actually buy their plants in the fall.
So you can see.
Because then you can actually see what you're getting. Because there is some variability, especially when we look at some of the shrubs, like burning bushes and some of those. Because sometimes I'll have people call and they'll say, it just never turns that bright red. Well, there's a certain amount of variability sometimes in there, and some of them just don't do that. So genetics is certainly a part of this. So sometimes that's a good idea just to, if you're really looking for that great tree. But also, just again, back to genetics, is some of the cultivars, some of our cultivated varieties have been selected for good fall color, and we've certainly seen that in a number of maples that have, you know, Red Sunset, and I'm sure Mike could list a whole bunch of other cultivars that are really meant for really good fall color. So certainly maples and some of those would be ones that you might select for really good fall color. But there's some great native trees for fall color. One of my favorites is actually black gum. And it's really a super tree, as in it has these wonderful shades of kind of purples and little orange and then some yellow underneath. So these, and it's a native tree, and it's a great tree, certainly for a yard situation. I don't know how well they do in kind of those street situations, Mike, but it's certainly a great tree for fall color. Even things like smaller trees like serviceberry, it's another great one for fall color. So sometimes just selecting even some of those native trees and maybe getting away from some of the traditional ones we think of, like maples.
Mike, what trees do you look for really good foliage?
Well, one thing I was going to add to that is that mixing the colors up. So everybody wants a red tree for the fall color, but it looks much better when you have your yellows and golds and your oranges and your purples all mixed together. So look for variety. And the other thing that I mentioned to folks who want a colorful tree is not to because it's just a couple weeks out of the year. There are a number of other features to think about on your trees for selecting them. So there's ornamental bark. There's beautiful glossy green leaves on some trees in the summer, so they actually reflect their leaves. Their bicolor leaves. There are leaves that are silver on one side and dark green on the other. In fact, the silver linden is a pretty neat tree because it acts as a barometer. It has a very fuzzy silver side and one side and a dark green side on the other. And the leaves will flip when the barometric pressure increases, and it is a tree that I think tells us when it's going to rain. So those kinds of things are fun. Fall color is great, and I like bald cypress. It has a rusty kind of an orangey color would be another one that would mix it up a little bit. Larches have a beautiful golden orange color. The ginkgo is wonderful. It's got a lemon yellow color to its leaf.
Wow.
And the neat thing about the ginkgo is that it drops all its leaves at once. So the morning after your first frost, if you can look out the window, it's just raining ginkgo leaves. So that's a really neat feature with ginkgo trees. So there's a lot of things to think about.
If you go over to our website at will.illinois.edu/focus and the page for today's Focus program, you'll find a link to a webpage on fall foliage put together by the University of Illinois Extension called The Miracle of Fall, and it has a lot of links to other websites to look at about fall foliage, where to find the bright fall foliage, how it's doing this year, both here in Illinois and in other states as well. There's also a little link on the side for another page called Pumpkins and More, and that really comes into a question that we've received from a listener. I have noticed that squirrels will come and eat the pumpkins people put out of the fall.
Absolutely.
In Champaign-Urbana, but I live in Sydney, and they don't touch mine. Why would that be?
I don't. You know, squirrels are one of those things that a lot of it depends on, you know, population. You know, in some areas they have a higher population of squirrels, and so they tend to get into a little bit more trouble.
I think my neighborhood has more squirrels than
people.
Yeah,
you have a lot of, especially large trees, you know, that have been there for a long time. You end up with these large populations. So that may be part of it, just populations. Also, what else is out there? Sometimes I think they're going for moisture as much as anything, but they certainly, you know, it's something that they can eat. So I think a lot of it sort of depends on that. And also, you know, if people have dogs or something like that, sometimes that, you know, the squirrels go to somebody else's
so
house.
So maybe in Sydney where there are more animals running, there might be more animals running off the leash in Sydney would make a squirrel more cautious?
Well, certainly. That certainly could be part of it. But also, I would also say just the population. I mean, obviously, if you have a bigger metropolitan area like Champaign-Urbana together, there's lots of areas for squirrels to be in parks and to move from one area to another as the population's grow. And so I think that may be part of it there. But it's tough.
She just has spookier faces.
Just spookier faces, really. Maybe she's spookier pumpkins. Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, I hear that a lot. People spend a lot of money on, you know, and actually even raccoons and some other animals will actually go ahead and feast on pumpkins.
Well, this is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows, and we're talking about lawn, garden, and tree issues with Sandy Mason from the U of I Extension and the City of Urbana's arborist, Mike Brunk. Our phone number is 1-800-222-9455, 1-800-222-WYLL, or email your questions to WYLL-talk@illinois.edu. Here's a phone call, but let's go over to line four. Mitchell from Dewey, good morning. You're on Focus.
Hi. I was wondering what kind of tree or shrub we want to use. We are wanting to put up something for like a snow fence, but we'd like to be able to see over it from the house, and we prefer not. We're going to be planting a fair amount of them. We live out in the country, and just wondering what kind of tree or shrub would work the best, something that wouldn't get over maybe 10 foot tall.
And you're looking, tree or shrub, is that what you said?
Yeah, something that we could use that would work fairly well is like a snow fence.
So a snow fence, but not too tall.
Yeah.
Well, there's certainly crab apples that will stay. The sergeant crab apples and the Tina crab apple would stay smaller. You're not going to find many trees that are going to be under 10 feet.
Okay.
Those may be a couple that you could pursue. And the nice thing about crab apples are that they've got three-season interest in that they have fruit, flowers in the spring, and fall color, some of them. So that might be an option. There's probably a number of shrubs. There's the Ilex verticillata. What's the common name of that, Sandy?
I think it's possum haw, isn't it?
The winterberry
is
what I'm thinking of, yeah.
Yeah, I would think there'd be a number of shrubs that you could certainly use. There's actually a bunch of different viburnums. Arrowwood viburnum, I think, is one that's particularly nice. It might get a little bit above 10 feet, but not much. And they actually also provide their native. They also provide fruit for birds, those kind of things, which is really good. Even, you know, if you're really looking for kind of a, you know, low-cost thing, even things like red twig dogwoods do a pretty good job of that. Now, they do get some insect issues. Sometimes later on you have to trim them down. But they're very vigorous, as in you don't have to worry a lot about watering. You know, once they're established, you don't have to worry about watering them and stuff a lot. So that's particularly good. And also keep in mind, of course, is that when it comes to snow fence, you know, realize that the height of whatever you have here is going to make a big difference on the area that this is going to help protect against snow.
Yeah.
So you know that already. Okay. So if it's not very tall, it's usually 10 times the height, which is, you know, can be good. But in a rural situation, sometimes that's not good enough. So.
Yeah, we've got plenty of space out and just wanted to put it kind of at the edge of the building site to catch what we need to catch. So
some of those twiggier things sometimes are kind of nice. as well. There actually are some smaller service. There are service berries that are trees that would get 25 feet or so, but there are some service berries that are short, more like a shrub. Okay. And those would be another ones that are kind of nice that also provide fruit for the birds and nice fall color and all that kind of stuff. So, yeah, it'd be tough to find a lot of trees, as Mike said. It'd be tough to find a lot of trees that are going to stay under 10 feet.
Okay. All right.
Well, thank you very much for calling in, Mitchell. And let's go to another call on line one. This is Larry from Savoy. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello. Hi. Hey, I'm calling in because I have a 9-foot holly bush right next to the foundation of my house, and it's encroaching out onto the sidewalk. And I'm trying to figure out if I can prune that back, and if so, how much can I prune it back, or if it's something that has to be removed.
You want to take that one, Mike? No.
Certainly you can prune it back. Now, generally, you don't want to prune more than a third of the foliage off in any given season. But I would take hand pruners to it rather than shearing it, unless it's been sheared before.
No, it hasn't been sheared before. It looks like pretty much most of the greenery is out on the surface of the bush, and it's pretty much all open wood inside. And so any pruning, it looks like it would be taking off all the surface, and I didn't know if that was going to kill the plant. And if so, I would replace something else there, ornamental grass or something.
So how much
can be pruned back?
So how much do you need to remove? 6 inches, 8 inches, 12 inches?
Probably, I'm guessing, maybe about a foot.
Yeah. Go ahead, Mike.
And you're getting back into the dead zones, what you're saying. There's no leaves back in the area that you're...
Right.
So it's been sheared in the past.
I guess.
It's real dense on the outer part of the tree. And
yep.
You know, what you could do is, and it would be a little bit of an experiment, but I would suggest if you wanted to shear it back or hand prune it back, you do it little by little and not try to take it all at once.
And when should that be done?
Well, I probably the best time to do it would be springtime.
Okay.
Just before spring, just before at least it gets new growth. And you don't want to stress the plant, so you don't want to take too much foliage off at any given time. So I think by going little by little, you may be able to train it back to where it won't be over the sidewalk. But it sounds like it might be too big of a plant for the space, possibly.
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Yeah. This may be an ongoing issue for you is the problem.
Mm-hmm. Right. I just acquired the home, and so I'm looking at this bush, and I'm thinking, is this a issue for the foundation and the house and the walkway and just take it out? And I don't know what kind of soil chemistry is going to be there if I do take it out, and what would be a good replacement.
So it sounds like, sorry.
Is the holly dark green? Or is it yellowing? Do you see any kind of rose?
No, it's dark green.
Okay, so it sounds like your soil is acidic enough. But that's not a poor soil area. And how big is the space? Did you say?
It's probably about 5 feet wide.
So about a 5x5?
Yeah.
Well, again, there's a number of shrubs that might fit in that space, smaller shrubs or ornamental grasses that could work. I think you've got a lot of options. If you choose something to replace the holly with, choose it according to its mature size. So do some research on whatever you pick out and make sure you know the mature size of it would fit within those constraints if you decide to take the holly out.
But the holly's not going to make the soil alkaline or acidic enough that I'm going to have to be selective on what I put in its place.
No. They really don't change the soil pH. They do better under acidic conditions, but they're not really changing the soil pH. You really shouldn't have a problem. I would be really surprised if your soil is so acidic that you have to worry about other things that you're going to put in there. But it might be a good opportunity even to have something like there are some nice small azaleas and rhododendrons that you'd have to really pay attention to how the mature size, as Mike said. But there are some that if the holly's doing well, actually some of those would actually also do well.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Well, I want to say thank you to Larry. We've had a little problem with some ringing feedback on the line, but we do want to thank you for the question, which seems to be a bit of a stumper short of a house call out there.
It really is one of those things. I think for a lot of times it's a tough decision. I know it's really tough because you see this shrub and it actually still looks healthy, but it's just way too big for the site. And it's for some of these, especially evergreens and broadleaf evergreens, it's really tough to get them back to a manageable size and then to keep them at that manageable size. So I know it's really a difficult decision because you hate to take out really, you know, nice looking stuff. It just, they're too big. But sometimes you just have to, you know, face reality and realize it's just too big and it's going to be a common or regular maintenance issue for you.
Do you see that a lot in folks' yards, especially in older homes or places where someone has lived for a long time? You get attached to the tree or the plant that you maybe grew up with or raised your kids with. But there's just a time where in a limited lot. You can only handle it so large.
Well, and if you think about it, when you're buying them at the garden center, when you buy them, they're these cute little things. You see this a lot of times with evergreens, especially. There's this cute little thing, and oh, won't that be great? And you put it in, and it probably does look nice for maybe 10 to 15 years. But then that next homeowner that inherits it, or as it ages, then you realize that was just way too big. So Mike made a good point: is that really pay attention to what it says on the label, as in the mature size, and just plan on that. And I know it looks little in the beginning, but maybe plant annuals around it or perennials or something like that. Mm-hmm. But just to realize, really have to plan on that eventually there. And I'm convinced with our great soils that we have around here, whatever it says on the label, if it says it's going to get 4 to 6 feet tall, it'll get 6 feet tall around here. Yeah. I think they always go on that high range just because our soils are so darn good.
What's the rule of thumb, Mike, in terms of, that you would go by in terms of a tree being too big or too close? When would you say, this is a nice plant, but not here, and maybe it's time to remove it and replace it?
Well, certainly when a tree is doing damage to a house, that is a concern. So if it's rubbing your siding or, more importantly, rubbing your shingles, if you can't trim the tree and have adequate clearance without greatly harming the tree, then I think that the tree's been, is time for it to go and find something more appropriate. So you don't want to have your landscape plants causing damage to your home. So that's certainly a consideration. Now, I lived with a Norway spruce that was planted 1 foot away from the foundation of the house. And we had a picture of the house when it was built, or shortly thereafter, and the spruce was about 6 feet tall. And the people were standing next to it and standing in front of the house, and they had a cutesy landscape. Well, this thing was, when we moved in 2005 or 6, the spruce was 40, 50 feet tall. And I would have said that a tree that close to the foundation, certainly be concerned about the roots posing some structural problems to the foundation, but we didn't have any problems. So, but I have also seen where a tree in the front yard, I believe it was an elm tree, had roots, and it was about 25 feet from the house, come up through the basement floor.
Well, we have a caller now on line one, Karen. You're on Focus, and I think you have a question that's right on this subject.
Yes, it is. I was wondering, you've got to get rid of these trees that are too close to the house, but then what do you do about these roots? Sometimes, the root ball is very big, where you cut off the tree, ground level might be 6 inches or a foot, whatever, and then how do you keep those trees from coming back?
Well, a root is like a potato, so it's storage. So the best way to do it is when you take the tree out is to take the stump out as well, or as much of it as you can.
Yeah, but...
With a stump grinder.
So, but what if you can't get it all out, you know? So what can you do to make sure that it doesn't come back?
Where is the area?
On it, or?
Pardon me?
Should you put some kind of chemicals on it? Should you try to kill it that way?
Now, are you talking about a bare stump or just the suckers that are coming up from the root system?
Stump and suckers, yes. Both.
I would just keep them cut down. I wouldn't try a lot of chemicals, but is it an area where you mow?
Not what's right next to the house. No, it's not really.
And what kind of a tree?
I mean, it's right next to a fence. It's kind of grown up right inside of the fence, and it's distorted the fence. And so, I mean, I'm short of a grinder, which I actually can't run.
Well, another option for you is you can. Can you cut them by hand?
But every time I cut them, they keep coming back.
Okay, but make a fresh cut, and
uh-huh.
then you can daub them with full-strength Roundup.
Full-strength Roundup.
Full-strength Roundup, not diluted, but you want to daub it on the fresh wound.
And is that safe to do in terms of surrounding vegetation?
Well, sure. Roundup, it's a systemic, so... You're daubing it with a sponge applicator.
Okay.
So as long as you're careful, it's a non-selective herbicide, so as long as you're careful and don't drip it on other plants, it won't harm the other plants. But I take a little container out with me, I pour a little full-strength Roundup in there, and I use a sponge applicator, the kind you buy at hardware stores for painting.
So this is real localized. You don't want to, like, spray it on. You want to get just on a particular target.
Right. She's trying to poison with the systemic herbicide, the suckers. If you can't get a cutter to them, if you can't grind that area out, that would be one option for you. And Roundup is something a homeowner can buy. There are more potent chemicals, but it would take pesticide license to use those.
Well, Karen, thank you for your call. I hope you find a solution to your problem there. I'm going to take one more call before the break. And that's Ray from Effingham on line 4. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. My question is, I have some property, and I have a lot of walnut trees, and I don't want to get rid of any of them. But it seems like things underneath them, I planted some burning bush, and they're not doing anything. And I have planted some low-growing evergreens on a hillside that's under one of them, and they did well for 3 or 4 years, and then they all died. Is there certain things you can't plant under walnuts or around near walnuts?
There's more things you can't plant under them than there are things you can.
Okay.
And I don't have a list in front of me, but walnut trees produce the a toxin that's very, toxic to a lot of plants. So... there are plants that are tolerant of that. Do you know any off the top of your head?
Yeah, I think actually what I usually go to is Purdue put out a really nice fact sheet on, you know, which ones that do okay underneath walnuts and which don't. So if you just check Purdue Extension walnuts, it'll probably pop up. If you have internet access, hopefully you can go ahead and get that. And then it does list it. The funny thing is, or I shouldn't say funny thing, if you sort of look at different fact sheets from different states, they don't always exactly agree. So I will tell you, sometimes it is a little bit of trial and error on some of these things, but there are some, and just right off the top of my head, I can't think of anything that I know violets do really well underneath walnut trees. So if you like violets, I know those will grow really well.
Okay. How far away? Because I have a magnolia, and it's probably 20 feet away from the tree, but the trees are young yet.
Yeah.
Will it kill it, too?
Well, it's the fruit dropping near the tree. It could cause some problems. I don't know how sensitive magnolias are to
the
walnut.
Know.
The fruit has a lot to do with it. Now, of course, the roots and the leaves have a little bit of that toxin in it as well, but the fruit rind on the walnut shells are the biggie.
Okay, so if you keep those...
So wherever the fruit drops, you're going to have a hard time with some of these plants.
Yeah, and of course, as the tree, you know, the walnut trees get... age, you know, the roots are going to go out. But by then, probably the magnolia will have a pretty good root system as well. So you may not have quite the issue simply because of the age difference there. But I definitely check out that fact sheet. If you can't find it, then give me a call, and I'd be glad to find that for you.
All right. Well, okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Ray, for calling. We're going to take a short break now and be back with more talk and answers to your questions about lawn, garden, and trees here on Focus on WILL. We're back with the Lawn, Garden, and Trees edition of Focus on WILL. I'm Jim Meadows, and my guests are horticulture expert Sandy Mason of the University of Illinois Extension and Urbana City arborist Mike Brunk, and they can answer your lawn, garden, and tree questions. Phone them in at 1-800-222-9455. That's 1-800-222-WILL, or email us at WILL-talk@illinois.edu, and we're on Twitter and Facebook at Focus 580. The phone number again, 1-800-222-WILL. Mike, I was wondering about the emerald ash borer, which is sort of a continuing story as far as the fate of ash trees in Illinois, and what do we know now about how far that insect has spread throughout Illinois?
Well, it's following interstates. We have it in the community. Found in Champaign.
Have you found it in Urbana?
Not yet, but I don't doubt it might be there. We just haven't discovered it yet. So we're very concerned about it. We had started managing for EAB actively probably 4 or 5 years ago with a systematic removal of our poor ash trees so we could get our populations down.
You mean getting rid of the ones which are not doing well?
Right.
Okay.
If we have, and our ash population's pretty minimal. We're pretty fortunate in Urbana. We had 8% ash back in the 90s, and around 1997, 98, we stopped planting ash because we were having lots of problems with ash yellows. And
ash yellows?
Yeah, it's a disease in the adolescent-aged ash trees that we were having, and we were also having problems with limb breakage, and we wanted to reduce the numbers of our ash trees, and that's well before we were aware of the emerald ash borer. So we got our population down in Urbana to less than 4% at this time.
Now, and I happen to know somebody in Urbana who has an ash tree in their front yard. What should he be looking out for? The tree seems to be fine now. You know, I looked at it once and thought I saw something that looked like what I had seen in terms of pictures of the hole an emerald ash borer makes. But Sandy here was telling me that there are other boring insects besides the emerald ash borer that may not be so fatal that could make that mark as well.
Well, there's a number of different boring insects that you can see on an ash. The emerald ash borer is actually a fairly small hole, about an eighth of an inch, and it's D-shaped.
Small, V-shaped hole.
Yeah, and, you know, signs, rather than looking over your trunk for these little holes, is your tree dying back? Sucker growth is another sign where you see these advantageous suckers growing out of the trunk. The limbs flagging, you know, the dying back that I was talking about. But
these are all things the tree's trying to cope with the condition caused by the ash borer.
Right. And other things. The ash yellows will cause that same kind of a problem. Drought can cause the trees to flag. I mean, we have lots and lots of trees from last year's drought, and they're flagging with dead limbs that we're dealing with. So I think the most important thing is to keep your trees vigorous, water during dry periods, certainly be vigilant for that kind of dieback, and then it would toggle for you to look closer and consider whether you want to treat the tree or not.
Okay. You know, we have somebody on line 4, Jeff from Geneva, who tells us that he's been treating ash trees for about 4 years. Good morning, Jeff. You're on Focus.
Hey, good morning. Yeah, and you guys, I hope you're having a good day. It's a little mucky up here, but I'm doing good. Yeah, this year, or the last couple of years, actually, 4 years, I said, I've been treating my trees with, I have a guy come out, he's actually from Michigan, he comes out and does it, and he's been doing really good, actually. My trees looked, you know, the same they have been before the ash borer's been around. And I do have lots of my neighbors who didn't treat them. You can tell they're really, you know, I want to say 60%, pretty much 50, 60% dead. And my question is, a couple questions I have for you. One is, how long do I have to treat these things? And, I mean, say everybody takes and cuts all the trees down, how long afterwards do I got to keep treating them, or is it just like an indefinite thing? And do you ever see the ash tree or that type of species coming back?
Well, those are questions we all ponder on. I certainly, how long will you have to, there's different thoughts on how long you'll have to treat that. Most entomologists that I talk to think the emerald ash borer is going to be around forever now that we have it. There's other schools of thought that you treat the tree for the first wave that goes through, and when the ash population is greatly reduced, you may be able to get by with not treating your tree as often or not at all. It's kind of a gamble. And I wanted to ask you, do you know what your treatment is? Because there's a number of them out there.
Oh, I can't remember. The guy that does it up here, he's from Michigan.
Is it soil injection, or is he injecting the trunk?
What's that?
Is he injecting into the soil or pouring into the soil, or is he injecting the chemical into the tree?
Both. He's doing both. Twice a year he does it. The first in the spring and the fall, he goes, and he comes out, and he's got these little holes bored in the tree, little plastic, you know, little rubber stoppers in it. So he does that, and he's doing kind of it's a twofold thing where he does it both in the ground for the root system and the other way too. So I've seen him do it both ways when I've been there. So and it has, you can see where it pays off, because all the trees in my block that haven't been taken down, mine, especially the ones next door to me, mine's the only one with the, you know, lush green leaves on it. The other ones are just, it's really patchy, and man, we really took a big hit up here. I'm familiar with a little bit more of the pinus species trees, where, you know, like out west, they're having problems with some kind of bark beetle there too, wiping out one certain species of tree. And it seems like the ash tree, for some reason, got really kind of like the same thing, got hit really bad. And I'm surprised that, you know, this stuff we're putting in a tree doesn't kill it off and keep it out of there. I mean, I've been hearing different versions on how this, you know, how things like this would work. And I don't know, I still don't get it.
No permanent.
I've always experienced the tree stuff, but, it's mind-boggling, because it just seems to me, if you treat the tree enough, that, you know, if it's got enough of that stuff, residual stuff in it, you would think that they would tend to stay away from it. But
you know, the tree transpires, so you're moving the chemical through the tree as it flows sap. Your treatment, there are treatments out there you can treat once every couple years. It's an injection system. And they're all, experimental, if you will. This bug's only been around since 2002 that we're aware of, at least. And, there really hasn't been enough research to know how these chemicals will work long term. And, in fact, some of the research I've read says the best, they're unsure how it would work in a tree that's larger than 25 inches. So they've had their most success in trees with diameters of less than 25 inches. But to answer your two questions, you know, Mother Nature may come up with something that kills off EAB at some point in the future, and the ash could very easily come back. And how long will you need to treat it? That's a guess that we would all have to make. I don't know that we know.
Well, Jeff, I wish you luck. It sounds like you are on the front lines of ash tree protection. I just want to remind folks that we have a link on our website. If you go to will.illinois.edu/focus, you'll find a webpage about the emerald ash borer. It's actually emeraldashborer.info, with a lot of general information about the emerald ash borer, also some links to some pages which are Illinois-specific. This is Focus. I'm Jim Meadows. Still time for your questions about your lawn, garden, and trees from U of I Extension horticulture expert Sandy Mason, Urbana City arborist Mike Brunk, our number 1-800-222-9455, our email address will-talk@illinois.edu. On line one is the very patient George from Urbana. Good morning. You're on Focus.
Good morning. How are you?
Fine.
I have a question for Sandy and Mike. Now, it's about lawn, trees, and gardening. Well, I have all three, and my backyard has huge maple trees that provide great shade for the house, but the lawn does not grow. I've tried to plant shade tree lawn, and it doesn't work very well. The soil is kind of clay-like. And so I was wondering, is there anything like a substitute for lawn that may grow better?
Well, in the dense shade, maybe something like lily turf. Lily turf. Some call it liriope. Might work. Now, it's not only the shade. It sounds like if you have poor clay soil, that might be part of the problem.
Yeah, it's. I tried heavy shade grass last year, and it was coming up okay. And then we had the drought, and it killed it. This year, it's been pretty bad. It's what has survived is pretty slim, and not that my whole yard is dirt, but it's getting there. Do you suggest possibly cutting the trees down? But I mean, the shade really cools the house.
Plaintive cry from Sandy.
I'm crying. No.
Okay.
Yeah, your property values would be better off with the trees than it would be with no trees and just turf. Turf requires sun. So if you don't have sun in these certain areas where it's not growing, you're not going to have much luck. And I think Sandy could have some suggestions here too, but you're probably going to want a ground cover where the shade, where these bare areas are.
Okay.
And I would also suggest, if you have poor soil, that you might try aerating with as deep a aerator as you could get, and then over dressing the yard with compost. And you're trying to get some nutrients down into that soil for whatever ground cover you decide to plant to do a little better. Clay is hard for anything to grow in.
Yeah, it's you take a shovel and you hit that soil, and it's just hard as a rock. You know.
Yeah, that may be more of the problem than the shade, but the combination is a death song for turf, I think. Not if you had dappled shade. I've had really good luck with tall fescue. It's a tougher, more native-like turf.
Okay.
And it grows faster. You have to mow it more often in the springtime, but I planted it because I have dogs.
Sure.
And it's salt tolerant, so you don't get the spotting on it that you do with other turf.
I do have to say, you know, as Mike said, no grass grows in 100% shade. None of them do. I mean, if you go in the forest, you don't see a lot of grass growing. it just doesn't grow. They're sun plants. So I think your best bet is to sort of forget the grass.
Okay.
Unless you do have those few areas that Mike mentioned where you're getting at least some sun. Maybe in the morning, afternoon, in some of those areas you can actually get a little bit of sun in, and then the grass will do okay. The other thing I will say about maples is it's not just shade, it's dry shade. Because maples tend to have lots and lots and lots of leaves, and even on a very light sprinkle of rain, right underneath that tree, it's still dead bone dry. And that's the other part with maples, is that dry, dry shade. So, and because there's a lot of plants that don't like that either. So I think that's kind of the one thing to think about, is also just think about some ground covers if you want to go with, and even those, you're going to have to water them until they get established. So Mike mentioned the lily turf, which is great. Also, even, I don't know how you feel about hostas, but, you know, hostas are pretty tough plants once they get established.
Mm-hmm.
And then even, and they'll certainly take up a lot lot of space. Now, obviously, if you're wanting this for, it's a high traffic area, that's another issue when it comes to how well you're going to, some of these plants are going to do well, obviously. But I'd really think about some other plants. Actually, there's a plant called Barrenwort, and I know it's a horrible name. It's Epimedium, but it actually is pretty darn good under dry shade. Once it's established, the first year, but then it kind of spreads out, and actually it's kind of a nice little ground cover. There's also some Lamiums that actually do okay, and they're kind of a silver-colored leaf, so they're very pretty. So you may find you actually like it better because you have all this diversity in there as opposed to just having grass under there.
I'm wondering, and George, thanks for your call. I just want to change the subject over to something that we were talking about earlier that people can take advantage of now, and that is to sign up for a course in the Extension Master Gardener instruction. The instruction is next year, but if you really want to know about gardening, I understand this is the way to go.
Yeah, absolutely. People have a lot of interest in gardening, and then they also just want to give back to their community. I think the Master Gardener program is right there, as in you get to learn your own about your own backyard, but also about a whole lot of other things. The training, it usually runs, it's about 60 hours or so. In general, they're all-day trainings. You can also take it online if that works out better for you. And it's on everything from lawns to trees, shrubs, flowers, soil, fertilizer, insects, diseases. We have a lot of great instructors. You know, like Dr. Phil Nixon is, people probably know him from Mid-American Gardening as well as from this show, is one of our instructors. So there's a lot of great instructors. And then once you go through that training, then the agreement is then you'll get involved in community service type projects, everything from, you know, maybe local community gardens. It kind of varies from county to county on how they do it and what projects people are involved in. But I think it's a great way to get involved and get involved with a bunch of great people, because gardeners are just great people, period. So just check with your local county extension office, or you can just go to the state extension website for the University of Illinois and also for Purdue, and just go in and look and see at your local county office, you know, what kind of program they have available for it. But generally, applications are taken this time of year, and then the training generally starts in January or so.
Okay,
but
so
check
this,
with your local county.
This is an opportunity for people who really like gardening, and then perhaps also talking about gardening and meeting other people who want to learn about gardening.
Yeah, absolutely.
So if you're like a solitary, lonely gardener who just wants to just wants to make sure that their own yard is doing okay, maybe not the best opportunity for you.
Right.
But if you want to garden, learn about gardening, be among other people who want to learn about gardening, that sounds like the beginning of a great path.
Yeah, and there lots of wonderful social connections. I love that part of Master Gardening is that we do monthly programs, we have field trips, and there's just lots of opportunities that Master Gardener programs open up to folks. So I hope they take the advantage of that.
And just check with the extension office in their county.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm.
And they can get started from there.
Yeah, great.
Mike Brunk, I was wondering, I had heard there's been some issues with a fungus that's showing up in some oak trees. Is that something that you've been seeing in Urbana?
Oh, we've had some fungal problems certainly earlier this year with the wetness that we've had in the spring and midsummer. A couple types of fungal problems with oaks and a few other trees, but oak leaf blister was around, and we had a tabakia fungus in some of our oaks that caused some leaf drop. So it was a concern to people. We don't recommend treating the trees for that problem. It's more of an ornamental problem. And the best thing that people can do is to keep the tree vigorous in dry periods, keep it watered during these droughts like we're having now, and to keep the leaf litter picked up.
So
raking as that stuff falls.
Just a little tender loving care for that particular oak tree.
Yeah, right.
We have a question that's coming online. I think this will be the last one for the hour. From Sue, who writes that there's an ash in my neighbor's yard, ash tree, that's gone brown. Around the first week of September, the leaves at the ends of the branches started turning brown. Then the brown started moving in towards the center of the tree. By the third week of the month, the whole tree was brown. Is that a drought effect? The tree is old. It was mature when I moved here 20 years ago.
It very well could be. I've seen a number of trees brown and dropping their leaves now from this. Well, we've had the driest 2 months here in 116 years. So it surprised a lot of us. It's dry. It's been very dry. And yes, we're seeing leaf drop and early defoliation because of that.
Not necessarily an emerald ash borer problem. You would see something else with the borer there.
Well, it sounds to me like it's drought related. But without looking at the tree, that's just a guess.
You know, if it's a drought issue, does just watering the tree, could that be something that could, you know, it's hard if you have a whole bunch of trees, but if you just aim some water at a particular tree, can that help?
Oh, most certainly. Trees need a good, mature trees, large mature trees need a good drink once a month. So you really want to get them a good 1 or 2 inches of water once a month. And you can do that with a lawn sprinkler and watering your lawn. You figure that the roots on a tree spread out about 2 to 3 times as much as the tree is tall. So they go beyond your yard. So the best way to water a mature tree is to water your yard.
And is now too late in the year to do that?
No, not at all. You want your trees to go into the winter vigorously. When the ground freezes, it's a little harder for them to get water, and trees still need water even though they've dropped their leaves.
Well, we are out of time, but I hope we answered a lot of questions this time around about lawn and garden and tree care. Our thanks to U of I Extension horticulture expert Sandy Mason and Urbana City arborist Mike Brunk. I hope that cold clears up soon.
Thanks, Jim. Me too.
We welcome any additional thoughts you have about today's program on our website. Go to it directly at will.illinois.edu/focus. You'll find some links to information about fall foliage and the emerald ash borer. Today's show was produced by Lindsay Moon. Mike Pritchard is our technical director. Savory Lesk is our intern, helping with production and research. Monday on Focus, some of us use our hands a lot when we talk, and that's what psychologist Susan Golden Meadow of the University of Chicago likes to study. She says gestures may play a role in the language learning process, meaning that the gestures your child uses may be an important clue to their development. She'll be discussing her research Monday on Focus. Focus is live each weekday morning at 10, a replay at 8 p.m. I'm Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL.